Chair Tom Hammond isn't able to be here, so I'm going to be filling in. And first order of, first matter is to approve the minutes. I don't know if anyone has any comment about the minutes, but I'd love to, for Ms. Lester to just talk about the pricing of the pension fund obligations.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I was discussing with Mr. Groner previous to the meeting that yesterday, the pension obligation bond series 2013 were priced, and we're very happy to report that we did about 20 basis points better in each maturity than we did last year. Last year's maturities range from 75 basis points for the August 1st maturity to 95 basis points for the June 30th maturity. This year, for the 2013s, we priced at 58 basis points for the August 1st maturity and 76 basis points for the June 30th, 2014 maturity.
Great job. Does anyone have any comments on the minutes?
I'll move for approval.
Second.
Approved. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. So approved. The next item is the election of this committee, and I think essentially the concept was for the committee to stay as it's currently constructed. But is there some sort of process that you want us to go through?
We can open the floor for nominations of the chair, and then after the chair is voted on, we would open up the nominations for the vice chair.
I move that since he's not here, we make Mr. Hammond the chair.
I second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
That'll teach you not to show up.
He's stuck. And for the record, I know Chair Hammond loves being chair, and he wants to continue to be chair.
Doesn't matter. We were
going to
vote him
anyway. So approved. So
so then we would open up for the vice chair.
Make a motion for Carl to continue being vice chair.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
Well, I got to think about it.
All right. We ended up where we started from.
Congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And finally, the final matter is the new financing for the Teeter plan, and maybe we can hear from staff on where they are with that.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Public Finance staff requests that the Public Finance Advisory Committee approve changing the letter of credit facility with Wells Fargo, which supports the Teeter Commercial Paper Program, to a three-year tax-exempt note and reimbursement agreement. A little background. Since 2008, the county has utilized a commercial paper program backed by a Wells Fargo letter of credit to finance the county's Teeter program. The initial commercial paper outstanding was $178.3 million. We got up to as high as $211 million in 2009 at the height of tax delinquencies. The current commercial paper outstanding is $103,973,000. The reason why we're here today proposing a change in the way we finance the Teeter program is related to upcoming regulatory changes in the banking industry known as Basel III, and also the county's continuing goal of operating an efficient, cost-effective program. Basel III will mandate higher capital requirements for letters of credit, likely making them more difficult to secure and therefore more costly. We were operating under the knowledge of a January 1, 2015 full implementation date until this past Monday when we learned that regulators extended the full implementation date to 2019. However, many banks are targeting early compliance and are already making policy changes. County staff and the financing team of Wells Fargo, K&M Public Finance, and Orrick Harrington Sutcliffe Bond Council have worked to develop a program that will eliminate the letter of credit while retaining the current program's financing flexibility, maintaining the legal compliance with the 2008 judicial validation, as well as reducing the program's administrative cost. Under the terms of the proposed three-year note purchase and reimbursement agreement, Wells Fargo each year will purchase notes in the amount necessary to purchase the TEETER tax delinquencies from the participating taxing entities, not to exceed a total of $150 million. Interest will be paid monthly on the notes at the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, better known as SIFMA, index rate plus, and I'll make a correction to your packet where it was listed as 60 basis points on the utilized portion. It is now 58 basis points on the utilized portion, and that's a result of Wells Fargo's willingness to share in some additional cost savings with the county. The current utilized portion, as I mentioned, is $103,973,000. The commitment fee on the unutilized portion, so that's the difference between $150 million and the $103,973,000, that will accrue at a rate of 25 basis points per annum, payable quarterly in arrears. The reduced fee on the unutilized portion was not available under the letter of credit program. We paid 60 basis points on the whole line of credit. It will not be necessary to have a commercial paper remarketing agent, as Wells Fargo will be holding the notes from the county in its investment portfolio. After execution of the initial notes, the county would also largely avoid annual cost of issuance fees. We asked K&N Public Finance, the county's financial advisor, to review the proposal in the context of other similar transactions, and their analysis concluded that the proposal was fair, comparable, and should reduce financing costs by over $200,000 a year, or about $800,000 a year over the next 3 years, when also factoring in cost of issuance savings. Staff considers this program to be more cost-effective due to the split fee between the utilized and unutilized portions of the notes, and due to the fact that a remarketing agent, financial advisor, and bond counsel accept for an annual tax analysis to validate our tax-exempt status are not needed after the initial placement, and less risky than commercial paper, as the county's not exposed to credit conditions that affect the bank, which in turn affect how the county's commercial paper trades on the market. CEO Public Finance requests that your committee approve and recommend this change in the financing mechanism to the TEETER program, and are available to answer additional questions, as are we have folks available here from Wells Fargo, K&M Public Finance, and Orrick Harrington and Sutcliffe.
Yes.
Question?
You're recognized.
Thank you. It's hard not to because I'm sitting next
to
you.
I know.
What's the current default rate on our delinquent taxes? Our taxes?
It was below 2% this year. I think it's about 1.5%.
Which translates to what dollar amount? Nominal dollar amount.
The total tax roll was over $5.5 billion, so if someone has a calculator, they could probably take a look at that. I believe on the total, the secured, we were over 98.5% for that.
Collected, right?
Right, collected, right. and I did not bring, we have not gotten our statistics. I was hoping to get them for this meeting for the statistics based on last month's payments, but we have not gotten those statistics yet.
And I can add that this past year, the county purchased just a little over $50 million in teeter delinquencies. At the height of the delinquencies in July 2008, we purchased $136 million in delinquencies. So when the delinquencies increased, it was at a fast rate during this last cycle.
Last year, that number went, in 08 was 150 million. How much?
I'm sorry, can you repeat?
How much was it in 08?
The purchase of the delinquencies, 136 million.
It was 50 million last year?
Correct.
Prior to 08, prior to the crash, what was it?
Fiscal year, just going back a couple of years from there, in July 2007, it was about 89.5 million, and it was in that year was our first indicator that the county needed to restructure the program at that time, because previous to that we would take in tax collections and use those monies collected to purchase the delinquencies. And it was that July for the first time that the county was short $2.5 million, and the general fund had to backfill. And so it was at that time we knew a restructure was in order. Previous to July 2007, in 2006, it was 48.3 million delinquencies purchased, 2005, 33 million, and in 2004, 27 million.
Member Hughes, did you have a question?
No.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Just a follow-up question on Mrs. Hughes. When I look at the page 2 summary, it looks like on August 25th, 2008, we issued CP notes in the amount of $178 million. So my question was similar, is we've got the credit facility for $150 million. You know, what were those levels? But it did look like in 2008 that we did issue $178. So what are the expectations that the 150, and what are our options if we were to go over or have a need, because this is a three-year contract, I believe, for that based on what our delinquencies are?
Thank you, Committee Member Friedenrich. When we restructured the program in 2008, we had a line of credit. The letter of credit was for $300 million. Mm-hmm. And as delinquencies dropped and the needs were reduced, we reduced to $200 million, mm-hmm. and then $150 million, and then actually $125 million. Mm-hmm. But this proposal puts it back up to $150 million. So, you know, each year we start tracking the delinquent collections and the current year collections after the December installment, and you know, if we had a reason to be concerned, we would contact the bank and discuss you know, an increase in that in the note.
So just a follow on. So at this point, with the agreement on the table for the 150, if we were to go over, you would either have to fund it from internal resources to fund those similar as to what you did in 2007, or broker an additional amendment that would probably go through us with Wells Fargo that would increase the amount of that.
That's correct. And just to provide some additional information, if this item is approved and approved by the Board of Supervisors, when we issue the notes with Wells Fargo, it is our intent to use current collections through December, which is about $46 million, to pay down the commercial paper before reissuing sure. notes.
Is there an objective way that you're taking current delinquencies and the rate of new delinquencies to get to this $150 million number?
We do have a forecasting model that we use. However, it's our intent to be very conservative to, you know, ensure that there's plenty of buffer.
Yes.
And I just have some follow-on questions. First, I wanted to, and I apologize, I want to thank you for, you know, looking at this innovative approach, I think, to the issue. I remember when I was here, we had, I think it was Dexia with the letter of credit, and then we went to Wells Fargo. We appreciate them being open to some of these types of things, especially those that really look like they're saving taxpayers' dollars. So one is, you know, I do appreciate that very much. Just a couple of detail questions now. The CIFMA index rate is going to be plus that 58 rate, which you said has come down. So, thank you on that. What is that actual rate of CIFMA today? Just to give us a benchmark, I'm just not as familiar with what that rate is today.
Today it was 10 basis points.
So it's 10 basis points, okay. So it's 10 basis points, and then it's the 25 basis points per annum. Now, when I go back to page 3 of the fee and interest rate agreement, it talks about the 25 basis fee is based on the rating of the county. It looks like you've got a chart here that has Moody's, S&P, and Fitch, and it has levels. And so right now we are at level 1, which is the 25 basis point. This is the county's rating, because I believe the rating agencies rated down because it was a pension obligation bond. Other factors with it, they rated the current POBs, I believe, slightly lower, but the county rating stayed the same. Is that correct?
That's correct, and I believe this structure is based on lease revenue bonds.
So this rating here, is that did I miss that it is based on the lease rating bonds? I just want to make sure, because of course, you know, there are things coming up, things happen in the credit market. I know we've got our VLF lawsuit. We've got different things that S&P looked at when they rated the POB bonds that are certainly some uncertainty. And, you know, certainly, you know, I believe that the county has the ability to meet any of these challenges coming up. But certainly for an agreement, we want to make sure. So could I just make sure that is reflected, that what rating specifically that would be is the one here? And then it would go up if... What happens if one of them, say S&P, went to an A+, and Moody's and Fitch stayed at the AA3 and AA-? What would happen if you started a split rating off this schedule?
If there are three ratings and there's a split, it goes with
the lowest.
It's actually pretty, David Broadsley with
yes.
KNNI.
Yes.
It's actually, without the doctor in front of me, I have to call, but it basically it's 2 out of 3.
Okay.
And if it's split where they're all three different, it would become the middle rating.
Okay, great. But that is outlined in the document.
Yeah,
I did review it. And
specifically, if you look on, is that page? It takes a village. Page 2, Article 2 is the fees, and it talks about below the, if you look below the grid of ratings, there's a description, I think.
Okay, so it's associated with the lowest of the two highest ratings, only two rating agencies calculated the basis points for. So in looking at this, there are the parameters for the differences, and if it were to drop, then that 25 basis point would be fluctuating to represent additional risk to Wells Fargo for the change in rating on it.
That's correct.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for that. That was my question. The other item is, again, I appreciate the innovative approach you guys have looked at for this. And, you know, I know you've done a couple of examples of where the cost would be less, the approximately $150,000. And then you had KNN come in and review, and they thought it would be about $200,000 a year. I don't recall what those costs were, and I don't need them to move forward, but in future it would be nice to have some of that analysis detail attached as the back so we could see what those type of costs are. I'm assuming they were calculated, and again, it's great that we're looking to save between $150,000 and $200,000 a year, on a go-forward basis to assist in, you know, driving down these costs. We are seeing, as you know, higher collection rates, which means that there are less delinquent penalties occurring, which means the less revenue coming into the county. So obviously, if we can reduce these expenses, it definitely helps. And let me see if I had any other questions. I think those are the questions I had. I'll check if there's anything else. Thank you.
Are there any other comments or questions?
Just one.
Yes.
Right now we're at 0.58. Is that correct?
And that on the Teeter letter of credit, it's 60 basis points.
Okay, I thought you said it was.
Oh, I got it. Yeah, 58 is the proposal.
Okay, and how long is that guaranteed for?
It's it resets weekly based on the SIFMA index.
Okay, so it changes weekly.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yes. May we hear from a Wells representative?
Certainly.
Sure.
She is standing.
Hi, I'm Lynn Love with Wells Fargo's Government Banking Division and the relationship manager for the county's accounts with us. We just wanted to say thank you for the existing business that we have. Your team mentioned, the current structure, you know, left that 60 basis points on the total amount. And we feel this new structure provides some flexibility as well as cost savings to the county.
Could you speak to the situation that Member Friedrich alluded to, where we might potentially need to upsize the amount of the facility?
Absolutely. So the county's been a full banking service client of Wells Fargo since 2002. And the original letter of credit, we had provided up to $200 million. We're fully committed to the county and your credit needs. We just sized this to reflect the actual needs and usage. Okay. So we would certainly entertain and hopefully meet your needs for any additional credit requests that would come up.
Great. Were there any other questions?
I just had one follow-up, and thank you again. Ms. Love has been a great representative. We work very closely with her on the depository side, and we appreciate their partnership in this. And again, thank you for your innovative approach to looking at it that would really save the county money. Just a quick question on the prepayment. I know there is a prepayment. Maybe you could just describe, obviously, once the dollars are taken down, if a collection dollars come in quicker, or maybe you can describe that process. Thank you.
The process is we receive a Teeter tax apportionment each month. We receive base taxes, base delinquent taxes, which are pledged to pay down debt. And then we also receive penalties and interest, which once the program costs are paid, are discretionary to the county. And as we're collecting Teeter receipts, the structure allows us to prepay. What we've done in the past is we collect the delinquent taxes all year, and then as we're getting ready to purchase new delinquencies, we take the collections and we pay down the debt before we reissue and purchase the new year's delinquencies. So, you know, we would look at interest rates, and, you know, if we're paying more on the debt than we're earning in the county treasury, it's advantageous to us to prepay more often, which we intend on doing.
Great. Thank you very much for explaining that process. I appreciate it.
Any other questions?
No, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming. Can I get a motion?
I'll move the recommended action with the amended change to the 58 basis points for the interest rate agreement.
I'll second.
Everyone in favor?
Aye.
Aye. So approved. Thank you very much. It's a great job. And the last item on our agenda is a presentation. So if we could have the presenter move forward, it would be great.
I'd like to introduce Katie Koster from Piper Jaffray.
Good afternoon, committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come before you today and give you a brief overview on the fundamentals of land-secured financing. If you're not aware, the county has a substantial number of land-secured financings, currently in excess of 25 different series of bonds outstanding, both assessment districts and Mello-Roos districts. My name is Katie Koster. I'm a managing director with Piper Jaffray. We have an office here in Orange County, down in Laguna Beach, and we're happy to have been a client, or you've been a client of ours in the past. I want to keep this subject to a time frame. I've been given 30 minutes, and I hope to be able to touch what is a very detailed and complex type of financing at a very high level, but I also want to give you the opportunity to ask questions as we go along, so I'm going to pause after each slide, so feel free to ask me any questions necessary. We're going to cover today, again at a very high level, the definitions and purposes of land-secured financings, the types of projects which land-secured financings fund, the securities, the security and sources of repayment, the process of forming a land-secured district, the basic mechanics of a bond sale, as well as the refunding process and opportunities for the county. I have included as part of the package that you have in front of you three detailed exhibits, which I am not going to go through today, but are there for your reference. I will tell you as we're going along in the presentation when it would be appropriate to look at those exhibits, specifically a detailed comparison of the CFD Mello-Roos transactions and assessment districts, and then a detailed implementation step flowchart for the formation of a Mello-Roos district. And then finally, the last appendix shows an overview of your outstanding debt. So with that, let's get right into the presentation. What is land-secured municipal financing, and how is it different from the other types of financings that you're used to seeing? Probably the main reason for land-secured municipal financing was to allow the issuance of bonds that would be used to finance new development without burdening the entire community, but leaving the repayment of that to the community that was receiving the benefit of those facilities. It was a direct offshoot from Prop 13, which had in the past provided revenues for this type of development and the funding of those facilities. The owners of the properties within the districts are the ones that benefit from those facilities, and they are the ones who will be liened for the repayment, and they will return the payment through a special tax or an assessment district, which is levied and put on the county's tax rolls each year. Bonds may or may not be issued. Sometimes a bond is not issued, but the revenues that are produced from that district are used to pay for facilities on a pay-as-you-go basis, and or services are financed. If bonds are issued, the revenues are collected and used to pay the debt service on the bonds. And if bonds are not issued, then again, they go to pay-as-you-go for the facilities. The bonds, when they're originally issued for new formations, are generally issued on a non-rated basis. The history of land-secured financings is that they are typically used for large planned communities. In the case of Orange County, Ladera is a good example where a developer wants to come in and do a very large planned community that has a lot of backbone infrastructure needs. that can be funded on a tax-exempt basis and save the developer upfront money. Initially, until that the development actually occurs within the district, the developer is the one who is on the hook for paying those special taxes. And then as development occurs, the parcelization of the development lends to the lien following those parcels and then being collected by the homeowners or commercial purchasers of the property within the district. The property, again, is the security for the bonds, and the lien itself is superior to all other liens, including mortgages. So when you're looking at a lien for a special tax district, that would be paid out before a first trust deed to a mortgage holder. Foreclosure is the only remedy to collect for non-payment of special taxes.
I have a quick question. Thank you again for coming forth. This is certainly an important part of financing that the county uses, and it's great to have you here. And I really appreciate your putting the summary of the assessment districts and the Melrose back. I know that it's in the CAFR every year, but this is a fairly easy one to look at, so I appreciate
great.
That. A quick
Thank
question
you.
On the fourth bullet here. On the rating and that they're exempt from federal and state taxes.
That's correct.
Now, my understanding, and I'm a CPA, but I don't do taxes, is that Melrose is not possibly deductible. So I'm just so when you say it's exempt from federal and state taxes,
the interest component, that's correct.
Uh-huh. So you're talking about the interest side.
Exactly.
Of
it. Okay. And I would say as an individual, which, you know, you all reside within Orange County, it's very likely that you have a Melrose or an assessment district on your property, maybe multiple ones,
right.
That I would advise you to ask your tax advisor, mm-hmm. because there are some who will tell you that the interest component of that tax is tax deductible. I know that there have been some attempts at the federal level to cap that because it has been somewhat ambiguous. So it is something that you should check with your tax advisor on.
Right. Thank you. I wasn't thinking of the investor. I was thinking on the taxpayer side. So thank you for clarifying.
Sure.
That.
All right. So what's the risk of land secured financing? Well, this is not a general fund obligation in any way, shape, or form, and it is not a personal obligation of the person who resides in the home or owns the business that has the property within the district. The lien runs with the land. So if the property is sold, the new owner of that property is then obligated to make that special tax or assessment payment in the future. Again, the only way to collect on any delinquencies on that property is through the foreclosure process, and that can be subject to delays, and it can also be subject to bankruptcy proceedings. But the county and your role in the context of what you're due to the bondholder is simply to covenant to foreclose and to pursue that foreclosure process in a diligent and reasonable manner. Other than that, the risks of land secured financing track very closely to any other real estate type investment. And when we look at issuing land secured bonds, we look at it as a real estate transaction. And so many of the credit risks that would be material to an investor and that are material to the county in making a decision as to whether to go forward reside within in those types of real estate questions. Things like the concentration of ownership, the insufficiency of the special tax or assessment to pay back the debt service, risks related to homeowners with a high value to lien ratio or negative equity. We saw a lot of that over this last economic cycle. Direct and overlapping debt. Overlapping debt is all other direct debt that may be on that parcel as well. If there are multiple assessment districts or CFDs on a property, that's considered overlapping debt. And it is the county's policy to have an effective tax rate of not more than 2%. So all of that overlapping debt cannot exceed 2% of the value of that property. Another risk would be, of course, natural disasters and or hazardous substances that may be found on the property. Like any real estate property, you would need to make sure that it had value and any of these substances could lower that value. And then, of course, another risk, which is akin to all types of financings, it's the loss of the tax exemption.
I have just an additional question, and maybe our auditor controller, Ms. Grimes, might assist. I know that we do bill for the Melrose and some of these assessments, of course, on the tax bill. I believe that the costs of putting them on the tax bill are charged through to those property owners so that the county does not, you know, have additional cost for those. And maybe, I know Ms. Grimes does the apportionment or the tax rate areas. Is that true? So that, you know, when a property owner comes and says, we'd like to improve this property and put Melrose, so there's no real cost to the county because we collect the cost to bill for that.
I know that's true for special districts. I'm not sure if that definition includes the CFDs. That's something I can get clarity on.
Okay.
I believe that is the case for most land secure districts, that a budget is prepared before the levy of the tax goes on to the tax rolls, and that includes those override costs, including typically a line item for staff costs in administering the districts.
Great. That's just to make sure that people realize that, you know, when we do these, they are for a, you know, a property owner that's not the county. It's a, and those costs are then borne by that that district.
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. There are separate acts that give the legal authority for the formation of Melrose districts and assessment districts. And I'll start with Melrose districts. These were created back in 1982, again, as a direct result of Prop 13. It's called the Melrose Act because Mello and Roos were the two legislators that drafted the bill. The Melrose Act specifically allows for the formation of what's called a community facilities district, or a CFD. It also authorizes the financing of facilities, the provision of services, which is different from assessment districts, the issuance of bonds. There is, for Melrose districts, no requirement for a special benefit. That's actually probably the biggest difference between Melrose districts and assessment districts, and it does allow Melrose districts to provide a lot more flexibility in use. There is also no requirement for an apportionment of the tax based on benefit. In this case, what we call the rate and method of apportionment for CFDs is rather flexible. It can be designed to meet the needs of the existing CFD, and it really only requirement is that it be reasonable based on the benefit and general benefit of the parcels within the district. The lien, again, has the same priority as ad valorem taxes, and when a default occurs and foreclosure occurs, the Melrose lien is typically stripped from the rolls so that the foreclosure process can go forward in a more quick manner than if it were left on the rolls and had to wait for the regular 5-year period for ad valorem taxes.
And I apologize, I have one more quick question.
Sure.
You mentioned it has the same priority, because I know that one of the questions that's come up from some of the counties that are having significant difficulties, they're selling large numbers of properties and they're not even able to recover the penalties and taxes on the secured property taxes. Mm-hmm. So if we were to get a property in that had delinquent taxes and they also had delinquent Melrose taxes, would we have to apportion those so the county would take a possibly, say if there was $100,000 in taxes and $50,000 of Melrose taxes that were unpaid, the property were sold for $100,000, would that have to be apportioned between them, or would the county be able to take the $100,000 and consider theirs whole and the $50,000 of Melrose would be unpaid?
Right. They typically are considered pari passu. So they are on the same priority as ad valorem. Typically what will happen is that there is some negotiation before it goes to the sheriff's steps. There is leeway in the language for Melrose districts to waive penalties and interest and get back down to the corpus of the principal that's due to bondholders and the accrued interest. But at that point, then it would be apportioned pro rata.
Okay, and I might just indicate, you know, that would be something important in bringing these CFDs to the board here, because I wasn't aware that they were actually on the same priority, and I would look at that a little different, because now the county, of course, you are improving the property, you're putting the property, there's you know, pros and cons, but it would be something that would at least be important, and I don't remember if, I'm sure we've had some CFDs in the last couple of years, but maybe not.
If I might add,
2005 was the last new formation, but just one thing to note is the county's CFDs and assessment districts are part of the TEETER program, which the CFDs, they're subject to judicial foreclosure after 1 year, but because they're part of our TEETER program, we monitor the delinquencies, but day one, you know, we earn 10%, and then 1.5% per month in penalties. So after 5 years, you know, that has accrued, and then the tax collector initiates their foreclosure proceedings. And because the CFDs are in a TEETER program, the TEETER program has a tax loss reserve fund just for that purpose. If there was that difference and shortfall in the taxes, that tax loss reserve fund makes up the difference. And then we refund the tax loss reserve fund with the next delinquent taxes that we collect.
And I would add that unlike the economic downturn that we suffered in the 90s, where a lot of these districts had a lot of undeveloped property within them and there were large landholder concentrations, where if one property owner went delinquent, you had a major default on your hands. This cycle has been more the delinquencies caused by the homeowners who were over-leveraged. And in what we found very quickly was that the banks stepped in and made those tax payments because the amount of value that home had in comparison to the small dollar amount of the special tax did not warrant them walking away from the property. So I think that across the board, certainly for the case for Orange County, most of your districts are very mature and diversified, and the delinquency rates have been very low, excluding the fact that they're in TEETER, which gives you that much more protection.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm.
May I ask a question?
Certainly.
Can you talk about any market-driven differences in how CFDs are being looked at since the downturn?
Interestingly enough, land-secured financings are actually trading exceedingly well right now. And the reason is that, two-pronged reason. The first is a direct result of the fact that general fund appropriation credits have lost a little glamour. And they're trading off general obligation credits instead of one notch rating in the range of 2 to 5 notches rating. And the investor community is looking at those types of credits as less secure than a land-secured financing, which is a direct tax on property. So that has kind of boosted the desire for those holdings. Secondly, redevelopment debt is no longer in the market except for in the secondary markets. And that was another type of higher yielding type of credit. So there's a void there. There's more demand than there is supply. Most of the financings that have been done on land secure transactions over the past 2 to 3 years have been refundings, which mean the districts are much more mature. Oftentimes they have higher ratings. And they have the best yield an investor can get. So there's a lot of demand, which is driving the pricing down significantly.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Legal authority for assessment districts. There's actually three separate acts that have been used historically for assessment districts. The earliest of which is the 1911 Act. This act is rarely, if ever, used anymore, and so I'll concentrate on the 13 and 15 Act. The 13 Act is basically used to authorize the formation of assessment districts, and the 15 Act is used for the authorization of the issuance of bonds to go with the formation of those districts. And again, if you refer to Exhibit A, there is a very detailed comparison of what assessment districts and Mello-Roos districts will allow you to do, with the emphasis being that Mello-Roos districts over time have been seen to be more flexible. All right, so what do land-secured bonds finance? Basically, eligible projects are specific to state statutes. And the main difference, again, is that assessment districts must find a local special benefit in order to be able to finance the facility. So there's a much shorter list of facilities allowed under those acts than there is the Mello-Roos Act. In a Mello-Roos Act, you really are only required to come up with a reasonable general benefit. All public improvements financed in this way must have a useful life in excess of 5 years. They may or may not be physically located within the district. So regional facilities are allowed, and in particular in Mello-Roos districts. When construction occurs, the construction of the facilities must take place before the resolution of formation of the district, unless it's directly under the control and supervision of the issuing entity and prevailing wages are paid for the construction. So that does add to the cost. Local agencies like the county are allowed to enter into what's called a joint community facilities agreement, which would allow one financing to pay for facilities that are not only being owned and maintained by the county, but by other local jurisdictions, a water district, a school district, et cetera. The main key here is that whoever is issuing the debt must be using the majority of the proceeds from the bonds for facilities they own and maintain. Questions? The next slide here just gives you an idea of the types of facilities that are allowed. The large box on the top is more comprehensive, and again, assessment districts are going to be more limited and specific to a special benefit requirement. Again, no regional facilities are typically allowed under an assessment district. And what we find is that assessment districts are oftentimes now used for things such as undergrounding of utilities and road improvements and all of the other types of more broad regional facilities are being done under a Mello-Roos district.
May I ask a question? Mm-hmm. Can I interject? Can offsets or mitigants are in development arising out of EIR or CEQA process, can those be financed through a CFD?
I believe so, as long as they meet the requirement that they are a public facility. If you're talking about that there's a requirement out of the EIR that you mitigate something by putting in an extra sewer or extra water or, you know, widen the street, there's no reason why that would not be included.
What if it's a bird sanctuary at the site of a property that was the requirement for being approval? Is that sort of thing, could that be financed through CFD?
I think, again, it would depend on whether that bird sanctuary was considered a public facility, whether it was being maintained and operated by the county as opposed to a private entity. There may be specific restrictions, and I would advise you to talk to bond counsel about the specifics of that. But
just conceptually.
Yeah, conceptually. I mean, we've worked on transactions where there were requirements for environmental lands, protection of marshes, that kind of thing, and the public facilities that were required to improve those areas to meet requirements were included in the financing. All right, process of formation. The very first step of forming a district is going to be the requirement for goals and policies. And the county has done this and did this prior to the issuance of its first CFDs and assessment districts. In those local goals and policies, statute requires that you cover specific items. Of those, you are required to provide a definition for public benefit. And the requirement that anybody who petitions you to use this tool is providing, through the funding of these facilities, some type of public benefit. You also need to cover the priority of the facilities that are going to be constructed. And generally, that facilities list is rather large, so that it gives the county the flexibility as they move through time to adapt to the changes in the market environment. Credit quality is also addressed. Statute requires that you have a 3-to-1 value-to-lien ratio with three times the value of the property, the taxable property, as compared to the amount of the lien on the district. Oftentimes, issuers in their goals and policies will require that that value to lien be higher based on the issuer's desires. There's also a requirement to have disclosure to homeowners. This protects those homeowners who purchase a home after the fact, after a district has been formed, and this requirement is passed through the title process. So in those thick documents that you get when you purchase a home, there is specific requirement that there is a Mello Roos and what those payments are. There's also a requirement for specific appraisal standards. In California, the state requirement is a 3-to-1 value to lien based on an appraisal that's done based on CDAC standards by an MAI appraiser. And then there's also criteria that is specific to the issuer that determines the equity of the tax allocation through either the right and method of apportionment, in a CFD's case. In an assessment district's case, it's formula driven, and that is very specific.
When you talk about the 3-to-1 ratio of value, is that the value after the land has been improved, or is that the value of the land before it has been improved?
Right. There is a specific process that the appraiser goes through to determine that value, and it depends on the status of the development at the time the appraisal is done. So oftentimes, if a district is fully developed, we'll just use assessed value, because assessed value is typically the lower common denominator. If the property within the district is completely undeveloped, then the appraiser is required to do a cash flow appraisal, which uses a pro forma that
does,
is provided.
Does it include the improvement in value because of the facilities?
The improvements are a line item in
they
the
are.
Analysis.
So it's as completed.
Exactly, but then it's PV'd back. So in that process, they take the pro forma, what the estimated absorption
Understood.
Time is, et cetera, and then they net it all back. So it is a line item in there, but it isn't a 1-to-1 ratio at the end of the day because of the PV factor. All right. And as far as the equity for the Mello Roos districts, again, the flexibility of that rate and method of apportionment would allow the issuer to determine if they wanted to set that special tax based on square footage of home, on the size of the lot, a variety of different factors based on the development itself. So again, maximum flexibility from that particular tool. Yes, sir.
Can you have more than one assessment on the same parcel?
Absolutely.
So they can have multiple CFDs there.
That is correct. I actually used to live in Aliso Viejo, and I had 3 Mello Roos districts on my property and 2 homeowners associations.
You used to live there, right?
But I loved because the good thing about land secured districts is when somebody moves into a new home, the benefit of these types of districts is that you buy a home that has the school down the street, the parks are already in, the streets are already improved, you've got beautiful parks and transportation centers, as opposed to the neighborhood that may be a mile down the road without a land-secured district that is paying for those facilities on a pay-as-you-go basis, and you may live in that home 5 years before the neighborhood school gets built. So there is a benefit. And the other thing to remember is that the real estate market is such that if you have two home units selling right next door to each other. One has a Mello Roos and one doesn't. The homes that are selling with the Mello Roos have to adjust their prices downward because the typical home buyer is looking at their monthly cost. And that monthly cost is going to include both the mortgage and the taxes. So as the taxes go up, the mortgage amount needs to go down for comparable homes. So you'll see that you really do get a lot of benefit for that, and I think that was part of the reason that they were done so frequently when development had its heyday, despite the big signs on the freeway that said, no Mello Roos. All right, initiation of proceedings. And I'll go through this rather quickly. There is a detailed flow chart in Appendix B that describes the formation process for Mello-Roos districts. Initiation of proceedings is done typically in two ways. Either a developer will come to the issuing agency and put in a petition. That developer, and if there are less than 12 registered voters within the district, then the vote would be done by a majority of the landowners. The other way is if it's a fully mature district, it would be done by the legislative body, and a petition could be put in by two of the members of the body. Once that petition is put in, you also would enact your joint community facilities agreements if that is applicable. All right, security and sources of repayment. In general, and we've talked about this already, it is these financings are secured by a special tax or assessment, which is collected on the tax bill as a separate line item and on parity with ad valorem. They're allocated in accordance with either a rate and method of apportionment for Mello-Roos districts or an engineer's report in the case of assessment districts. When these bonds are issued, they initially almost always have a fully cash-funded debt service reserve fund at the lesser of the three-pronged IRS test, which is either 10% of the par amount of the bond proceeds, maximum annual debt service, or 125% of average annual debt service. Once the district is more mature and it's being refunded, perhaps it has a rating or insurance, there is more flexibility with how that reserve fund is funded. It could be funded at a lesser than 100% rate or perhaps with a surety. Many, many times when a Mello-Roos district or assessment district is initially sold with raw land, there would be a letter of credit or guarantee requirement of one type or another. This is additional backup either because the value is below that 3-to-1 number, or perhaps there's enough development risk that it would be material to an investor to have some kind of guarantee, perhaps a completion guarantee on the actual construction of the property. The bonds that are sold on new districts are typically not investment grade credits, although we oftentimes will get investment grade credits when we've gotten 10 years of diversification and development and we're going to refund the bonds. Insurance is relatively difficult to get on land secured financings unless you have a very large district. Typically, the insurer want to see in excess of 700 or 800 homes to add diversification as well as an investment grade credit before they provide insurance. Delinquencies do accrue penalties and interest, and as Suzanne stated, because of the TEETR program gets the advantage of that. Again, this is not a personal debt of the property owner, and the remedy is only foreclosure.
Who is responsible for monitoring the ability to refund and to run that process?
Interesting that you ask that. We actually at our we have a couple of slides in the back to talk about some of the opportunities there that you have on some of your districts. It's a team approach. I'm sure Suzanne probably gets a number of calls from underwriters such as ourselves who've worked with the county in the past, who are monitoring your debt and who on a periodic basis put in what the rates are at the given time and then provide her with an overview of what the opportunities are there. We talked a little bit about the foreclosure covenant. So real briefly, the issuer covenants in the bond documents that they will in fact foreclose under certain triggers. Those triggers differ by issuer. I think sort of the industry standard is that you want to foreclose as quickly as possible, but you don't want to do it when it's not cost effective. So if you have a home whose obligation is a couple hundred dollars a year, you probably are going to wait until that accumulates to be $1,000 delinquent before you start the process because it is a costly process to start. Other triggers tend to be if the delinquency rate is more than 5%, if the combined delinquencies are over a set dollar amount, et cetera. And then the foreclosure sale proceeds are then used to pay off the lien and on the delinquent property. The amount of time it takes to foreclose varies very widely. I've personally seen anywhere between a year and 5 years. It has shortened itself quite a bit. The 5 years was really back in the 90s when there were very large property owner delinquencies, and there was a lot of effort by those property owners to keep their property by lawsuit, which just muddied the playing field. Questions? All right. Mechanics of a bond sale. All right. 3-to-1 value to lien required by statute, established by assessed value or appraisal. The appraisal is the typical way when there is any undeveloped land within the district. Again, the vacant land would be appraised based on general assumptions about that development. A pro forma is given. There are a couple of additional consultants on these types of deals that will review on behalf of the issuer the assumptions that are provided by the developer for reasonableness. And we look specifically at the absorption rate and whether that's reasonable. We look at the pricing that's been provided. Is that reasonable? And then that market absorption study is incorporated as well into the appraisal when they're doing their cash flow. So they're a very critical part of the team. Legal documents that are required include a resolution of intention to issue bonds, a resolution of necessity to issue the bonds, and a resolution to incur the bonded indebtedness. Land secured transactions are almost always done by negotiated sale. This is primarily driven by the fact that every land secured deal is different. There are so many different credit factors, and again, it's because it's a real estate deal. They're much more complex, and again, I'm only touching on the real high level here. But it would not, in most cases, be to the benefit of the issuer to try to sell them on a competitive basis because of the complexity of the transaction itself. There is also a requirement to authorize a maximum par amount in the initial formation of the district. That par amount can be segregated and split into multiple series of bonds, however, over time. And that's often being done now as developers are developing smaller pieces of a master plan community over time, and therefore they're not bonding for a large amount and having to pay for debt they're not using because they can't spend down the proceeds quick enough. Any questions? All right. Bonds may be sold in series. They're sold in serial and term bonds. Typically, in the existing environment, serial bonds will go out anywhere between 10 and 20 years, and there would be one, maybe two term bonds out 30 years. Again, that's we're doing a fairly limited number of new formations at this given time just because the development cycle is down. We're doing a lot more refundings. These deals can be sold on a fixed or variable rate basis, although the variable rate is much more difficult and requires support by a letter of credit. The only one that I've seen done in that manner is the assessment districts that have been done for the past couple of decades for the city of Irvine, where the Irvine Company is the major developer and they support those deals from their own balance sheet. The maximum amount of interest that can be paid on these deals is 12%, and the debt service is paid annually or semi-annually, very typical to other types of financings, and the term of repayment cannot exceed 40 years. I would say I haven't seen many, if any, that have done the whole 40 years, mostly 25 and 30 years. The financing team, very similar to what you see on other types of transactions, bond counsel, of course, to provide your tax-exempt opinion. You'll have a financial advisor, an underwriter, disclosure and underwriter's counsel that prepares the final offering document. In these cases, the appraiser, which we've talked about, is a very important part of the process, and the market absorption consultant. You will also have a trustee or a fiscal agent agreement, which holds and invests the funds for you. And you will have a district administrator or engineer of record. The district administrator is the title given to the financial consultant for CFDs, and an engineer of record is for assessment districts. They pretty much do the same types of work, which are to prepare the allocation of the tax, either through the rate and method or through the engineer's report. They prepare tables for the offering document. And then in most cases, they go on to provide services on an annual basis to levy the tax in accordance with the rate and method, to track disclosures or to track delinquencies, and then to prepare ongoing disclosure for the issuer. Initial bond disclosure. This would be the preliminary offering document that's prepared for land secured financing and the key elements that are in it. As in most other types of transactions, you're going to have a description of the bonds, including the authority for the issuance, a debt service schedule, optional and mandatory redemption provisions, as well as the sources and uses of funds. You'll also have a description, and again, a fairly flexible description as to what public facilities are actually being financed through this transaction. You're going to have a description of the security for the bonds, which goes into detail about the special taxes. If it's a residential development, that may include a breakdown of the different sizes of homes and what each size of home is going to be paying and what their effective tax rate is compared to the expected pricing of the homes. You'll disclose the reserve fund and how that's being capitalized. You'll have land value estimates through the appraisal. And you'll also be disclosing whether or not additional bonds can be issued in the future. This pertains to when you have authorized, for instance, $100 million in a district, but you're doing multiple series and perhaps you're only selling 25. An investor finds that material because once you issue the subsequent series, then they're diluted somewhat on that value to lien. And then, of course, the foreclosure provisions. Key to any land secure transaction is, of course, going to be the development plan and the status of the development. When a district is very new, we will have very detailed project pro formas and developer information. It's very key to the credit analysis as to the experience of the developer and that they have an expertise in this type of financing, have done them in the past. We also have a complete bondholder risk section. And then there will be appendices which include the detail to the rate and method of apportionment or assessment engineer's report. The appraisal will be an appendix in its entirety, as well as the market absorption report, and then, of course, key legal documents and continuing disclosure as in other types of financings. For the developer plan and profile, some of the detail that we require from developers to do our own credit analysis, as well as to give all the material information to investors, includes a developer's financial resources, since they are typically the ones who will be paying the special tax or assessment for the first few years of the debt. It's important to know how they're capitalized and whether there's equity being provided into the deal. We need to know their experience level with these types of financings, whether they've had previous delinquencies with these types of financings. What's their overall reputation? Are they a Lennar or are they a small regional builder? What is their development plan and does it hold water after review from our financial analysts, the market absorption consultant, and the appraiser? Are there any regulatory hurdles that they need to go through? I would say that in most cases, if there's a significant regulatory hurdle, like an EIR or some type of a discretionary approval that's required, that the formation can go forward, but the bond sale itself is held up until those regulatory hurdles are passed. And then, of course, the project specifications and status, and that is specific to the public facilities. How much of that has been built already? What's the estimated time and cost for doing so?
May I follow up on your comment that the developer is paying the interest? Mm-hmm. Do these financings allow for
capitalized interest?
Capitalized interest?
They do. They do.
And is there a limit on how much you could put into a deal?
Yes, 3 years of capitalized interest is the maximum. Most do 2 years or less. Because it's expensive, you know, a developer, it's kind of an interesting process when you're forming the district, because oftentimes the issuer and the developer are on opposite sides of the spectrum of what they want, and a developer may push for as much capitalized interest as possible where you want to have less, because it brings down the cost that's ultimately passed on to the homeowner or the property
sure.
owner. But it is allowed. It is fairly common for new formations. So yes.
So the developer typically isn't paying the interest. Is there some sort of reserve or balance sheet requirement that the developer would have to maintain?
I wouldn't, you know, again, every deal is very, very different. I would say that we like to see the developer have some skin in the game. So we're looking at equity that they've put into the project. And that can take a lot of different forms. If there is no equity, then it would be some type of construction guarantee requirement. I think California has really progressed a lot from the early 90s in what the issuers are requiring of developers and how safe these deals are. And so it's very important to make sure that we know that we have a developer on the other end who has the capacity to pay back the debt service, but also the willingness, because that's sometimes where you run into problems.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. What determines pricing on a land secured transaction? There are many factors. Again, looking at this as a real estate type of investment, we're going to look at the credit factors that any real estate investment would have. Location, location, location. We've seen over time, and particularly at this current time in the market, that a transaction that is coastally located, Orange County, compared to an Inland Empire deal, will trade 50 to 75 basis points better, just on that location. Value to lien is also a critical factor, and all of these credit factors are going to be the same things that investors look at, as well as the rating agencies and the insurers. So that's important to keep in mind. Value to lien, we've over time sort of developed an understanding with the rating agencies as to where you need to be to get certain credit levels.
How many rating agencies do you need?
Well,
is two sufficient?
You know, one is sufficient. Actually,
one is sufficient
on a land secure deal, and I would say industry standard is to go to one. I can't remember the last time that anyone went to three.
No. That's great.
Yeah, and so if in your preliminary analysis it seems as though your value to lien is going to be less than 10 to 1. You're probably going to be selling that deal non-rated. It's not going to reach the level of an investment-grade credit. Coverage is also important. Coverage is the amount of additional revenues that can be produced by the rate and method of apportionment in excess of what the debt service is. To the extent your coverage is above 110%, you're going to get a benefit from both investors and the rating agencies. Interesting thing happened over time, and that was that there is a statute requirement that says that if you have residential property with homeowners in it, you cannot, from on a year-to-year basis, increase the amount of the tax on those residential homeowners by more than 10%. So if you have a district that's all residential, you will never exceed 110 coverage. So a commercial district, interestingly enough, may have 150 coverage and may actually be more creditworthy than a fully developed, diversified residential property, all other things being equal. Development status is, of course, important. If you have undeveloped property in the district as opposed to a fully developed property, the fully developed property is going to be more creditworthy. Effective tax rate. The effective tax rate is, again, that percentage. And the county and their goals and policies has a 2% effective tax rate that they don't want to exceed. So the overlapping taxes, all of them, all three of the ones I had on my old home, and my ad valorem has to be less than 2% of the value of my home. Land use. We just talked about that, commercial versus residential. Delinquency rates are certainly important, more important for refundings, obviously, because there isn't a historical delinquency rate in a new issue. And then outstanding parity debt. if there have been several phases of development that have occurred before, and now you're loading on more debt onto the same property. Then, of course, the developer's strengths and ability to perform is going to be a strong factor. The prevailing overall market interest rates, which we discussed a bit as well, supply and demand for land secured, and then, of course, if you have a rating or some type of credit enhancement. Questions? Nope. So, I pulled an example of one of the county's Mello Roost districts, being the Ladera Ranch district that I referenced earlier. This was a master plan community, 8,000 single family and multifamily homes, as well as commercial, schools, parks, and recreational amenities. There were actually six adjacent CFDs that were formed to pay for the infrastructure necessary for this development over time. And the bonds were sold in a phased manner. All of the bonds had 30-year amortizations, and at this point in time, their final maturity is 2034, so they are more mature, about 10 years out, and the majority of the development out there has occurred. This is a prime example of how the burden of the tax shifted from the developer in the early stages to the homeowners and retail tenants. There have been subsequent refundings that have been done on some of the outstanding debt. You currently have about $120 million in outstanding debt that at current market rates has the opportunity to be refunded for substantial economic savings.
A quick question. Mm-hmm. On the refunding, because the debt is being issued on behalf of maybe a developer, and then obviously as it matures, homeowners, whose responsibility is it to look for those refunding opportunities? I know you mentioned people come regularly. Is that a fiduciary responsibility of the county to do that, or is it vague? I always wondered, because I know when I was in Huntington Beach, there were some that I would say we should do this, but they said, well, it's not going to benefit the city, so we're going to spend our time on doing it, but it's a taxpayer benefit because those people will then see, you know, less assessments on their tax bills.
Yeah, absolutely. I would fall short from calling it a fiduciary duty. Mello Roost District is a separate legal entity from the issuing agency that sells it. There's a, while the board members wear a different hat, you know, so to speak, but it is a separate legal entity. But your point is well made. I mean, at the end of the day, most refundings aren't done until these properties are diverse and have taxpayers there. And so to the extent that it benefits those property taxpayers, it seems wise to have the agency that is overseeing that to take a look at that. Now, there are certain Mello Roost districts where, and school districts come to mind, where the way that the rate and method is drafted, you can pay for pay-as-you-go facilities, and therefore, if there's additional authorization left, you can do a refunding, and the savings can be used to transfer those monies into a pot to pay for additional facilities if necessary. Uh-huh. It's one option given the specifics of your particular transaction. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, especially in this environment where people are continuing to get taxed higher and higher, politically, it could be a good thing. Definitely financially, it's a good thing for the property owners, but it won't benefit the general fund at all.
Right.
So there's a weighing, and I would say for refundings that most of my clients have a minimum threshold of at least 3% NPV savings to have them spend the time to actually go through the motions to do the refundings. Currently, with staff levels being lower and the amount of time that's required for these types of transactions, they've raised that to about 5%. Mm-hmm. But because the market is so strong, we're finding that savings are so far in excess of that, you know, it's almost like it's a no-brainer to some degree.
Hopefully those dollars would go back into the economy if they're not being paid
exactly
in taxes. And it's exactly, you know, certainly it's the investors that are holding them are happy with those higher
right,
tax rates, but it does go back into the economy a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
And great. That obviously has to be weighed with staff time and other priorities and that right, kind of thing. So, So as far as refundings, there's really two types of refundings, an advanced and a current refunding. The definition is triggered off the original documents, which will have an optional redemption provision, and that's, you know, depending on the market, it's usually a 10-year call protection for the investors. When that first optional call date comes up, there's usually a premium associated with it for a couple of years, and then it goes down to par where there's no premium. An advanced refunding would be if you were going to issue refunding bonds prior to 90 days in advance of that optional call date, and you would set up an escrow. You have one bullet to do that. You can do that once over the history of a bond issue. That was new legislation back in 1986. The other type of refunding is a current refunding, and as long as you're within 90 days of that first optional call date, you can do a current refunding, and there's no requirement as to how many of those you can do.
Just a quick question. I know you mentioned you could purchase the slugs to avoid the yield burning. I know that right now, I believe the Treasury has eliminated the issuance of any slugs because of the debt ceiling and the, you know, it would increase the debt. How often has that happened where they have interest? What they are is these are instruments that they will issue at whatever rate you want. So if you need to get a 2% rate, or obviously it's below the market rate, but they will issue them, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's actually a schedule of what the rate is that they're given at any given time. And usually if you're doing a current refunding, you're either buying a 30, a 60, or a 90-day slug, state and local government securities. But they do, you know, they do earn some interest. I know of twice that I'm aware of where they close the window, and it's always revolving around the debt ceiling and fiscal cliff that we've been hearing of. Mm-hmm. And what we do in lieu of that is we do a cash escrow. Okay. So there's a little expense that you're going to have because of that window. It doesn't prohibit you from going forward, but you won't earn that today very meager amount that they would be giving you in the slugs anyway, but okay. It would be a cash escrow.
Thank you.
So just as a very high-level summary for the Ladera Ranch refundings, you currently have a 2003 Series A and a 2004 Series A, both in the amount of, you know, roughly $50 to $60 million for a total of almost $120 million in outstanding bonds. At today's rates, these go out to 34, so they're about 20-year maturity. They're earning slightly less than 5% on the long end in today's market, which would be a true interest cost on average of about 4.15. You have the opportunity, if you were to refund these as a current refunding in May, to be redeemed August the 15th at par of over 12% NPV savings, which is a total of almost $15 million. Total savings to the property owners, and that ends up being almost $1 million annually. So pretty significant savings. I know that Suzanne has been seeing numbers for a while, and Colleen before that, from a variety of different underwriters. In this particular case, you know, there have been other priorities to this, and that's benefited the county because we've seen rates come down pretty dramatically since we were first showing this to her. So that's a good thing. That's my presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Koster. Any other questions?
I had a trivia question. On that list of Manila Roosters,
yes.
Yeah, one of them left for $475,000. What's Santa Teresita? Where is that?
I don't know.
Never heard of it.
Ms. Hughes, could you repeat the question?
On the summary of the Manila Roosters,
what page are you?
It's that.
Oh, okay.
Special revenue bond issued in 99. It says it has $475,000 left.
Santa Teresita is in Lake Forest, kind of in that industrial area, I think, around Bake and Alton.
Those industrial complexes that are...
Right. I'm going to look back at one of my staff who's there.
Commercial.
Commercial.
And one of the things that we did when we were looking at these numbers, and the numbers that I just showed to you on the screen were just for Ladera. You also have a number of other CFD and assessment district outstanding transactions that are also refundable, which you can see on this sheet. I did not provide the detail to those, but as you can see, there are several of them in each that, if pooled together, could provide you in excess of 5%. 5% was the threshold that Suzanne and I had talked about in the past, that we wanted to, you know, toss out anything that didn't reach that level before we pooled them together. And there's obviously, you know, you bring up the good point of the Santa Teresita deal. There's so little left there while the amount is less than, you know, $500,000. It may be at a 4% level. You may want to throw that in there just to make, you know, ease of administration, because the amount is so small. You can make those fine-tune which ones go in the pool and which ones go out based on your particular goals and objectives.
So basically, it looks like we've got Irvine Coast is the hot deal now. That's it on that assessment, yeah. Newport Irvine.
Sounds like a rational thing to do.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank
really
you
appreciate
all.
It.
Have a good afternoon. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Do we have any comments from the public or anything that any of the committee members would like to add?
That was a very thorough and very professional presentation. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. I believe our next meeting is Valentine's Day, it looks like.
Why are we meeting on Valentine's Day?
Is there any possibility to move that meeting? No, I won't be here for that.
Seriously, I'm a divorce lawyer. I get to celebrate Valentine's. They
Your
line
phone
up,
doesn't ring that
no,
day.
No, they line up at the courthouse, and every third one I go, I get you.
We'll determine if there's a need to have a meeting at all next month, and early on we'll poll the committee members to see when would be the most convenient date if we need a meeting.
So if I have to come to this meeting, I'll need her services.
Completely understood.
Well, thank you, everyone. This meeting is adjourned.